Thank you, Don. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio. I'm looking at producer Griffin Filipich. Joe Brandon Sports is here. All the dogs are in the house.
Woof.
For an unusual Saturday. Everybody give me their best woof. Kleppen, go.
Oof.
I don't know how I can. Arf. I don't know if I'm going to be able to top that.
Sorry.
Now the game's not fun. Nobody can play anymore.
It's probably not my best, but, you know.
I'm glad that Joe did the story about Lou Alcindor. Was that you or was that you, Don, doing it as a news story about Lou Alcindor giving some money from his auction to his Skyhook charity?
Oh, that was me, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, giving auctioning off his championship rings and stuff to Skyhook.
Did I just call him Lou Alcindor?
You did?
I guess he won some of that when he was... No, maybe not. He was always in the NBA. Was he always in the NBA, Jabbar? I don't know why I said Lou Alcindor. I was thinking about him, though. Because when you were doing the story, I thought, oh, no, he's in such desperate financial straits.
Right.
He needs the money, which happens sometimes with, you know, professional athletes and entertainers. And you just kind of shake your head at that. But it happens. That's not why he's doing this, though, right?
No. He's doing it because he says he's just, in his words, rather than keep his treasures kind of locked up in a trophy room, he said he would rather give everything in order to help kids, basically.
Yeah, there's a cool quote. When it comes to choosing between storing a championship ring or a trophy in a room or providing kids with an opportunity to change their lives, the choice becomes pretty simple.
And really, how much joy do those things bring you?
Right.
This point in your life, everybody knows... You know, you're Jabbar, you're one of the great guys, you're blah, blah, blah.
You were so. An airplane, right?
You're in that AT&T commercial.
Oh, no. But here's the segue for me. We've all been following in Chicago, particularly at this radio station, the fact that the Chicago White Sox did not get Manny Machado for, I believe it was $7 trillion. And we didn't get Bryce Harper. He's going to Philadelphia, and they're actually going to move the city to a location more comfortable for him. I don't know if you guys saw that.
No, it's impressive, though, an impressive contract.
In reading about, though, the Harper deal, I read that while he's going to get, help me, guys, $330 million?
Correct, 13 mm-hmm. years.
13 years, $330 million. That's God's way of telling an owner he has too much money. But while he's going to get all of that, he's also going to get a bonus. If he wins the league batting title, if he wins a Golden Glove, if he makes the All-Star team, if he's the MVP of the World Series or the league, et cetera, et cetera. Those bonuses come in at about $50,000 or $100,000 each. If you're making $330 million, how is a $50,000 bonus compelling to you?
That's right. Exactly what I thought. I think the MVP is a $500,000 payout. What's even the point of that?
It's not an incentive.
In the words of Don Draper, that's what the money's for. Well, I mean, really, they should. When he and his agent sat down, okay, we're $330 million. We'll give you what a small village will earn for a century if you can just play baseball well for even half of the 13 years. Here's all the money God's ever created. And then Harper and his agent go, yeah, but what if we become MVP? And they're like, no, we just gave you all the money.
Right.
I mean, in fact, that's what the money's for. Do you think we're giving you this so you can hit 264 again, you dope? No, we're giving you all this money because we expect you. This is what we pay for an MVP. And then when you achieve the level of success that the money represents, you don't get extra money. In fact, you should give us some back if you don't do that stuff.
Yeah.
It's to the point where his grandchildren aren't going to have to work.
No, I mean, literally, I talk about this all the time, Joe, but $2 million is what a person will make in their lifetime if for 40 years they make $50,000 a year and most people don't. So that's $2 million. Okay, he's going to get 330 of those. So he's going to get what, say, 150 people will earn in their lifetimes. Or, you know, back it up, how many generations? It's just an insane amount of money. Mm. And I find that offensive. Now, I know the argument for that is, yeah, but we place a value on exceptional skills or talents. And, you know, if a singer is a great singer, they get to have a lot of money. And it's the marketplace. We give it to them. But I still think there's something skewed about a society or an owner or something's wrong when Bryce Harper gets $330 million.
Yep.
You know, debate that amongst yourselves.
But I guess I would say these
especially like NBA teams, but any team right now is a very profitable enterprise for the owner, right? Like,
yep.
The value just goes up. Like,
huge. Look at the Cubs, yeah.
Every year, incredible numbers for like pretty much across the board, even losing franchises, mm-hmm. is my understanding.
Okay.
Which is limited.
No, I'll give you that.
Do you want that profit to go straight to the owners? I don't want them to have it either. Like, you know what I mean? They,
right. So
you're
what's
saying
the counter?
If those numbers are going up, somebody's got to get paid. And I look, it's insane. I agree. But
it's not charity, but they're making money by giving him that money.
If that money doesn't go to Bryce Harper, it's just staying in the owner's pocket. Like, if he was able to somehow amass the same team and pay less money.
Well, wouldn't that be nice? I mean, when I get to be King Griff...
No, I'm saying that would be bad.
No, I'm saying that the owners and the players don't get so much money. That, in fact, the cost of a ticket goes down and families with balloons and the children's hands will be able to skip into the stadiums and the sun is shining.
Yeah, everyone gets a hot dog.
Are you positioning me as anti-family with balloon? Because it's not how I want to come off. It's not what I'm saying.
Griffin Philippich doesn't like families.
That's why I'm voting for Preckwinkle.
This is why I was not elected mayor. And I was on the ballot.
It's the kids. Went against the kids, man.
So I know that I always run into a logical corner when I start to rant like this, but I don't think I'm alone.
I think everyone's on your side, but no one has an answer, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
It's just kind of something that has snowballed over the years. I mean, you take a sport that has no salary cap and teams willing to do whatever possible to get the best talent available, and each time this happens... the price tag's going to go up. I mean, Manny Machado, $300 million, it still wasn't the biggest, but in that short amount of time, I think his AAV is the most. I mean, he's getting $30 million a year. Now Bryce Harper signs the most money ever in the 13-year span. So, I mean, it's only going to go north. Now, you can make the argument that those are two specific cases because they're elite talent and they're 26 years old. But this is just what happens with this market.
Yeah, but so 26, what's 26 plus 13? Does anybody know?
39.
Griff, look that up. So he'll be on his way to 40, and they're still owing him $30-plus million a year.
Yeah. I mean,
really, what you're buying is the first half of that contract. Think how inflated that is.
I like Joe played an audio bite from Chris Bryant earlier this morning, and it was like Chris Bryant wasn't even really reacting to the dollar figure. He was reacting to the fact that Bryce was going to be 39 when the contract was over, and you just hear Chris Bryant like contemplating age, basically going,
dude,
like, oh my God,
yeah, he was just wrapping around his head that he's going to turn 39 at one point.
Yeah,
I have the solution to at least the bonus part because we got into this conversation just now over Jabbar selling some of his relics, his artifacts, his souvenirs, and turning it over to a charity. Why wouldn't Harper and his agent say every time he wins a bonus? He will give that to his charity or to some charity. Now, maybe he will, or maybe he'll give even more than that. I'm sure he is, but there was just another layer of offense to me this week about the money, and I thought, wouldn't a good end of the story say, he signed for $1 trillion, he's going to get $50,000 if he's the league MVP, and that money will automatically go to the Children's Charities of Philadelphia? Maybe it would, but that hasn't been announced yet, and I think that would have been a nice way to put a bow on that.
Remember when Chris Long said he would donate? Well, he did donate his entire year's salary to what was
who
it?
Did that?
The Chris Long,
yeah, the Eagles.
Oh,
player.
That's right.
The,
yeah.
To what was it? To the public school foundation?
Something.
Or?
I think he might. I don't know if he has a foundation or if that was. Too...
Do you remember the scene in Mr. Deeds where he just give it to whatever fund?
Yes.
Scholarship fund.
The camp.
I mean, imagine if Bryce Harper did something like that and some random foundation just picks up a check for $25.8 million.
Right. Think what a game changer that would be. Didn't Mark McGwire famously say to the St. Louis Cardinals at the end of his career, you know, I'm not earning this money and you guys need to give me less? My estimated probability of accuracy on that anecdote is in the 60s. It's like 62%. I'm pretty sure at some point in his career, Mark McGwire, not hitting as well as he was earning, said, nah, take some of the money back, or something like that. Wally wanted to jump in here. Thanks for listening, Wally. You're on WGN. Hi.
Hey, John. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Good. Boy, I am 100% aligned with you on this. You know, it was funny to me, all this hand-wringing that was occurring when Manny Machado wasn't coming. Oh, how terrible this is, how terrible this is. I'm going to just give you a couple real quick numbers here.
Okay, I'm writing them down.
Okay. The average base salary for a Chicago police officer is $73,000 a year. Manny Machado, every time he comes to bat with that contract, every time, whether he strikes out, whether he grounds out, whether he doesn't feel like running, he's going to get $50,000. He's getting $200,000 a game. So let's just assume he bats four times in that game.
Yeah.
He's getting $50,000 every at-bat for the next 10 years. And so by the middle of his second at-bat of the year, he will have made more money than the average base salary for a Chicago police officer who puts his or her life on the line every single day. And we've got teachers who have to buy school supplies for their kids, you know, in the class. And this guy's making $50,000 every at-bat. And people say, we're going to miss him, we're going to miss him. Bryce Harper is making $44,000 at-bat. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And now the Cubs next year wants everybody to pay just to watch the game. With this deal that they signed with the new, the cable channel or whatever.
Sinclair, yeah.
That's where the money's going. That's where the money is coming from for these salaries, I think. It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
All right, Wally, you get to continue to listen to the show. You are.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. You and I are on the same page. It's 10:21. The phone number to call or text is 312-981-7200. It's a free call. I believe. What do you got there, Griff?
Well, you talked about Mark McGwire very nobly giving back some of his salary, and that was half true. You get a half true on that one. That's close enough. That's about where you put your probability at.
For me, that's pretty dang good. What's the story?
I'm reading from the Chicago Tribune in 2001. McGwire will earn $14 million in 2002 and $16 million in 2003. The two-year $30 million package is far less than McGwire would command as a free agent. And so he wasn't giving already earned salary back. It was a contract extension where he took less than he could have going somewhere else, probably. Yeah. And that was so that they could sign new people.
Oh, my version is even better.
Yeah, I think you said that he took something around like $100 a year.
it's a little Disney'd up.
He was very brave.
I had him picking up trash with an orange vest on the highway and helping children, like those
feeding soup to the poor
United Way videos.
Could we do like a 15 years later? Just how did you survive on that $14 million, Mark?
Okay, all right.
Such different times back then.
It just wasn't enough.
A 30 for 30 on those 2 years of Mark McGwire's life.
Okay, Griff, I think you've made your point.
Oh, and somebody called in saying Bobby Orr did something similar with the Blackhawks at the end of his career.
Well, Bryce, if you're listening, Mr. Harper, I would make, you know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. If you make a big splash out of giving some of the money to a charitable cause, then you seem to be grandstanding. But I think you should, and I'll bet he will. I don't think he's a dummy about this. I would make some sort of, why not? For every bonus I earn in my contract, I'm going to give it to, and then pull a name out of a hat and give it to a school or a micro business on the south side of Philadelphia or something like that.
Wasn't it Mark Zuckerberg recently that donated a couple $1 million to charity? Granted, wasn't that for a tax write-off, but I still love the thought of it.
Well, he had a huge investment in Newark's school system, public school system. That was around $100 million, I think.
No kidding.
That was a few years ago, or maybe like 5-10 years ago. I can't remember. Well, not 10, but a longish time ago. And that was a huge deal and a lot of press for him. But then that fell under criticism, too, because they kind of just... The criticism was they threw money at the system and didn't know how to use it properly. And I think it was probably a net success overall, but there were a lot of criticisms of how that money was used. So it's...
Oprah ran into some of that, too,
yeah.
with her school and with some of her other pet projects. And I'm not going to fault these people for their inefficiencies. Ted Turner started this, billionaires, let's all die paupers kind of idea. And by paupers, I mean, you know, $50 million. But I mean, if they're going to give the money away or some of it and it's not done perfectly, let's not all stand in line to criticize that. Let's not be on that team, right?
No, but if there's money that can be used better,
yeah, and then
it's worth
and then
pointing
higher.
Out.
You betcha.
Yeah.
So I want to do this. We'll pause here. Don's going to do the news. There's two books I mentioned that I had read that I just want to pass along a micro review to you. I think you'll enjoy hearing a little bit about these. And then also there was a call, two calls that we had with a guest the other day on our show this week. And while we play back part of the Mincing Rascals podcast as a broadcast at 11:10, we will do that. But I also want to play back just a two-minute-long conversation one of our guests had with some listeners this week that I think you'll find astounding. We'll do that in the next half hour. It's 10:28 on WGN. Thank you very much, Don Kleppen, John Williams in the Allstate Skyline studio. Remember, on social media, I'm WGN King John. That's on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I've also got a page at WGNradio.com. But on social media, like and follow us, WGN King John. And remember, the Mincing Rascals podcast that we record on Thursdays. We just threw a new issue up Thursday about 5 p.m. with a fun video to go along. Was judged by the Headliners Club to be the best podcast in Chicago. That's a nod to people like Steve Bertrand here and Eric Zorn over at the Chicago Tribune and the rest of the gang that are always in the Mincing Rascals podcast. We kick around the news and we'll do a little of that in about a half an hour. Let's just finish the conversation that we've been having about how much money Manny Machado, Bryce Harper are getting. You know, Paul Sullivan's article in the Chicago Tribune today is that White Sox fans are right to, or at least have a right to be upset that the White Sox didn't make a significant enough play to land one of those players, although even Sullivan says, but maybe 10, 13 years is too much for those players. So it's a real gamble, and I don't know, even if you were only concerned about the quality of play and not the money, even Sullivan is saying, yeah, maybe that's not such a good idea. But he understands why you'll be ticked, White Sox fans, that we don't have a marquee signing this year when two marquee players were out there.
Well, most of the contracts now in sports, let alone baseball, are not really substantial to, you know, they don't match up. In baseball, a lot of times you're paying for what you've done, rather what you're going to do. That was the exception this year with Machado and Harper, who are two young guys that have the majority of their career in front of them. But that's kind of what you have to do to land these guys now, is to pay more money than you need to, and to offer more years than they're probably going to be in their prime for. That's what it takes. That's the unfortunate thing.
I was talking about the amount that they do and don't give to charity, and this call poured in. Mark, you're on WGN. Hello.
Hey, John.
This is my brother. Okay, so you'll be the last call on this, Mark. What's your wisdom?
Well, I think we are so, you know, someone wants to give $1 million, and the first thing we say is, geez, they're grandstanding. And
if a player or a famous person gives money to charity, yeah.
Yeah, and two things. Number one, shut up. And number two, a lot of times the charities that they're giving to want that name recognition. They want to know that Bryce Harper, John Williams, or Bill Gates, or whoever it is donating to this. So we think it's grandstanding a lot, and a lot of times it's more a headache for them to have their name associated, because people talk about how they're not giving enough, or they're just grandstanding, or whatever it is. And a lot of times those charities really appreciate the fact that you're willing to put your name there, and then other people will say, yeah, I want to give to the same charity as Bill Gates or John Williams or Bryce Harper.
Yeah. I don't remember who the celebrity was, but one night at the Oscars, somebody got up and got an award. I'm pretty sure it was an Oscars. And his speech was about clean water and how we all need to. And it wasn't like a documentarian, but he said, I want you to know about this clean water initiative because people in the world don't have clean water. And I thought, I actually thought that was a pretty cool use of the time there on stage. I don't know if that relates exactly to what you're saying, but I guarantee you that that got a lot of attention towards a charity that would not have otherwise had it. So if your point is, if a Bryce Harper is willing to take the lumps for grandstanding when he donates money, because in the long run that's going to be good for the charity, fair enough. I get that.
Yeah.
What's the charity then that you guys, if you guys all had a, Joe, you just won the league hitting title, $50,000 fell into your lap. Where are you going to send that, Joe Brand?
The John Williams Scholarship
Fund. No. I'm going to give it to the Salvation Army or Feed My Starving Children. Those are two of my pet projects. Really good causes. Look them up.
Probably into the CPS.
Yeah, there's no bad choices, really, right?
Just keep it local.
Big brothers, big sisters.
Yeah, I know you worked with them once upon a time, and that's a great organization, too. Yeah.
Misericordia, I think.
Yeah. You know, think about all of the good that Lou Manfredini has done for Misericordia. You know, they existed before him and will without him, but boy, has Lou put his name to that organization. Mm-hmm. And I guess you too, huh, Don? How about you, Mark? You got one you love?
Big Brothers, Big Sisters.
Oh, yeah, right. And Griff, you're not giving significant sums of money to charities yet. All right. Thanks for the call, man.
See ya.
It's my brother.
So you're a younger brother or older brother?
I don't know.
Who remembers?
Depends on the day. He is my little 6'4" brother.
Some days he's not even your brother, right?
Yeah, right. That's just what brothers do, mm-hmm. if that's your point. Okay. Ray Kaplan is an attorney in town. She advertises on this radio station only because once upon a time I heard about student debt. And I said, well, let's get somebody on to talk about how much student debt people have. And so she came on the air and since then became an advertiser. I say all of that just to say I'm not plugging a sponsor here. We found out about her before she ever spent a nickel on WGN radio. And the story this week was that the people between the ages of 19 and 28, those millennials, are now at $1 trillion in debt. 70% of the debt they carry, most of that is student loan debt. 70% of the young people who graduate from college today graduate with student debt. That's no surprise, 70%. And that the average amount they carry is $30,000, which sounds about right, too, doesn't it? I mean, it's too much, but that's pretty much what happens when you get a college education. And you feel like you got to get a college education. Problem is, a lot of people carry even more debt than that, and parents sign notes to help the students get the debt. So now the students have debt, and the parents have debt. So Ray Kaplan came on, and we were taking calls, and people were saying, okay, here's my situation. What should I do? Here are two calls from that guest, Ray Kaplan.
Oh, my God. Okay, my son has $250,000 in loans from pharmacy school.
Oof. That's...
So he pays like a mortgage, not a car payment, a mortgage payment every month, $2,300 a month. And he's been paying for 2 years and the principal hasn't even moved.
That's right. And those are federal loans?
Yes.
I'm sure we can get that payment down for him because I'm sure his income is good, but that sounds like it's a lot more than 10 to 15% of his gross disposable earnings. And then his payment would be decreased even if he has children or any other dependents. And I think that sounds like one of those cases where we could get the payment down by 50%.
Can you ballpark me his income? Do you know generally how much he earns, Dana?
$120,000.
Right. So, I mean, we're talking 10 to 15% of his gross disposable earnings. So likely we could get his payment down 50% or more. Maybe his payment should be right around $800 or $900 a month or so.
Instead of $2,300.
Right.
And then as the parents, like, we had to take out a lot also because when you're in undergrad, they don't give the kids that much, so we had to take it all out. So I have about $150,000 from two kids, you know?
Well, all of the same payment plans under the statute also apply to you and people with Parent Plus loans. Yours is a little bit higher if you have Parent Plus loans, and that'll be a 20% of your gross disposable earnings, but still, it's still going to be a very low payment. The main thing is to make sure that you're in the right payment plan.
So your family's $400,000 on the line for college educations. Is that right, Dana?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Good luck to you, Dana. I really appreciate your call, and I wish you the best. Well, Marianne, you're on WGN. Hi, Marianne.
Hi, John. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, thank you. What can I do for you?
I, too, have a boatload of Parent Plus loans. I'm wondering, after paying for so many years, I originally started out with about $128,000, and I'm now at $65,000. And my monthly payment is still killing me at $678.
What's your annual income?
It's about $75,000 now with just him.
Hold on. What do you have to say?
Do you also have an income?
Just Social Security and a small pension.
So here's the thing. You actually are eligible for $0 monthly repayment.
Huh?
Yes, because your Social Security and retirement income are not the type of income that, as per the statute, that you're required to have them base the payment on. So because that's your income, now you don't want them to take into consideration your husband's income, and there's a way to apply for that too. You likely are eligible for a $0 monthly repayment until the balance is forgiven. And that's exactly the type of thing that people don't know about, John.
That's Ray Kaplan. Okay, so there's just two points about this. You know, I like to start the show saying, Monday through Friday anyway, we play a little thing that says, thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. My big thought about student debt is that when I get to be king, universities will not be able to enroll you in class if you are carrying too much debt. And we'll argue about what that number would be and what the major is and what the earning potential is. But I think it's criminal that they continue to walk kids through their Ivy halls for years and years and years, just running the register on those kids. And then they send them out with a degree, maybe in engineering, but maybe in philosophy. And those kids have huge debt. And yeah, these are adults making somewhat informed or not informed decisions about the debt that those kids are going to carry. But I think that whole enterprise is just corrupt. And I think it's wrong for these people. Now, here's the other thing. And that is the statutes, as she said, for many of you are written so that you don't have to pay back all of that, or at least there are schedules. 10% of your income, if you're a parent, 20% of your disposable income, which isn't all of your income. And people don't know that, and they don't pay as little as they could or should be. And if you pay consistently over like 10 years, then some of the debt's even forgiven. Have another conversation with your friends about whether or not that should happen. But the point is, the laws are on your side, and too many people just don't know that. And those numbers are just staggering, Griff. I just listen to that, and I just think, even if you're a pharmacist, I could see if your kid says, I want to be a pharmacist. Oh, it's a great living, and it's a great career. And I'll look at that. 2 years out, I'm making $120,000. But 2 years out, I'm $250,000 in debt, and I can't pay on the principal. It's crazy. So I just wanted to pass that along. If you're not alone, and that guest's name is Ray Kaplan, and her Chicago company is called, her website is financialrelief.com, financialrelief.com. Okay, it's 1049. This is WGN. Mark Baser is the guy who comes on our show sometimes, and he does a kind of a comedy talk show at a place called The Hideout. He had another show last night. His next show will be his 100th. He's done it for 10 years now. He's really been out there that long. And one of his guests last night, so he's got just like a talk show TV set, right? A desk, stands up and does a little comedy. Then he's got a sofa, and there's a bunch of us standing in this bar watching him interview really smart, terrific people. He played a highlight reel. The first one was Michael Wilbon. It's national names, and it's also local folks. So one of his guests last night was a scientist and educator from the University of Chicago who wrote a book about climate change, David Archer. That book was called The Long Thaw. And the takeaway, for me anyway, from a pretty zany interview, because this guy was kind of like, imagine what a University of Chicago physical scientist looks like. This guy looks like that. And you know, he wasn't soundbite friendly. And I think everybody knew that. So it was kind of hilarious, but also kind of compelling. And the takeaway for me, there were a couple of them. One is this guy about climate change and recycling and stuff was, he says recycling does not much matter. Every time I find somebody that affirms my view on that, Griffin, you know I'm going to highlight it, right? That's kind of like one of my things. I mean, we should, like, he said that recycling is harmless. It doesn't hurt anything. But 91% of the things that you recycle get burned and put into the atmosphere anyway.
I just think you need to make the turn quickly on that point, which is, so let's reinvest our energies somewhere else that would be more effective. But you do kind of like to leave it at, it doesn't matter. And I don't know.
I guess the point you're making goes without saying.
Oh, does it? I don't know if everybody feels that way.
He also said this, our kids and grandkids are going to be okay, but future generations are going to look back at you and me today and wonder why we were fiddling as the world was melting. He still feels an obligation to ride his bicycle to work. And he regards our flying around on jets just because we can as irresponsible. But he suggests that the safe number of carbon parts per billion in the atmosphere, or he had some equation like that, is 350. That's the line of demarcation for us. And he said we're over 400. So he was very dour about humanity. And he sort of apologized for his view. He got up and threw his hands up in the air at the end of the interview and said, sorry, but what am I supposed to say for you? But this is the interesting point of the conversation, too. He's talking to Mark Baser on stage last night, and he says that our conversations about climate change and global warming tend to go about 80 years out. We think about what's going to happen in the year 2100, what will happen to our kids or grandkids. He is looking several hundred years forward, when humans and cities and baseball teams would probably still exist. And he says oceans for those people will be 150 feet higher. Now, I've talked to other climate scientists about this topic, and some of them are more optimistic about mankind's ability to stall that. But this real smart guy at the U of C was just kind of like game over. You know, so then the next guest comes up and sits there and goes, okay, thanks a lot. You want to follow that act? But somebody did. His book, if you're interested, and maybe you're not now, is called The Long Thaw. And then the other book that I have been reading and just finished is called Team of Vipers by a guy named Cliff Sims, who is a former special assistant to the president and was so for 500 days for almost the first two full years of Donald Trump's presidency. He was his right-hand man. And the book is really interesting. Think about this. This book, when it came out, it's called Team of Vipers, was sort of billed as a disgruntled employee who's now giving the dirt on Donald Trump. I read the book cover to cover and took notes on it. And I'm telling you, it is a much more nuanced book than that. And there's a couple of anecdotes. I mean, listen, you don't have to like this guy. I don't either. In fact, I'm kind of glad he doesn't want to come on the show, because I'd like to be considerate to my guests, and that would be a challenge for me. But he's just got some fly-on-the-wall moments, famous things like Scaramucci or the inaugural crowd debate, that you go, what were those people thinking? What was going on in the White House? Well, this guy was there and was actually writing some of the words that those people were saying. And what he says about it is really compelling. Now, I'm going to pause here because it's time for the news, but I'll finish this on the other side. And if you want that book, anyway, to find out for yourself what it's like, it's Cliff Sims, Team of Vipers. Thank you, Don. This is John Williams. At the risk of sounding like Lou Manfredini, who just popped in here during the news, why is Joe Brand wearing a tie? Lou concerns himself much with, I think, sort of comportment and deportment of our staff. What's going on over there?
Not trying to show up anyone. No, we are wrapping up the UIC women's basketball season today. I got a game over at the Credit Union One Arena at noon.
We will be able to see you on TV then?
Yeah, online, ESPN3.com or ESPN.com, I guess, watch ESPN or on the app.
Not broadcast, but at least online today.
Correct.
You have been on TV a lot lately, though, Joe.
Yeah, I got to go down to Redbird Arena, old stomping grounds in Bloomington Normal last weekend. Did sidelines for the 2A Girls State Championship. It was a lot of fun. Dorothy Gators with her 10th state championship.
Yeah.
She's been there 45 years. What a game, too. They didn't have the lead until 44 seconds left in the contest, and they beat Tutopolis, two really good programs.
Heard you talking about that earlier today with Lou. And so remember, too, you can also see us on WGN Radio at WGNRadio.com right now. You can listen to us on the radio. You can listen to us on the stream. You can watch us on the stream. Something Don Kleppen might want to think about when he's picking out his tie next Saturday.
No, I can't compete with Joe, man.
This will be the last day I'll wear a tie. I'm almost positive.
It better be, man, because I am just outclassed in here.
Just a reminder, guys, that we're all visible. I mean, they're looking at us right now. And
scary.
Maybe more of them even as I speak.
It's scary to me.
The Mincing Rascals was judged by the Headliners Club to be the best podcast in Chicago, thanks to people like Eric Zorn, a Tribune columnist, and Scott Stantis, who draws their editorial cartoons, our Patty Vasquez and Justin Kaufman, and Steve Bertrand, who hosts the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is Steve where we'll start today. The podcast is ready for you to listen to and download right now, but we'll broadcast part of it here on a Saturday. And we start with the gang talking about the mayoral election this past Tuesday, right? And Bertrand wondering a little bit about, I think this is Bertrand we start with, his thoughts about Jerry Joyce.
Who thinks there might be a story in the late Jerry Joyce advertising? I mean, he didn't show up anywhere, and then he was on this radio station a lot in the last week or 10 days, right? And the thought is that he siphoned votes from Bill Daley from the Southwest side, and that he might have been the difference in Daley.
The counter-narrative to that is that the people who were supporting Joyce, that, a lot of working people, a lot of union people were not supporting Daley because he was talking about his interest in trying to open up the pensions, that he wants to change the pension clause in the state constitution, and this would hurt public worker pensions, and the unionized workers are not in favor of that. I wasn't sure what he thought his path to victory was. He never polled very well.
He was not a great guest.
I thought he was pretty unimpressive.
Really. What do you think of Patty?
He was not a great guest. I mean, I had him on. I know some other hosts had him on. It was tough to get, I mean, he seemed nervous and flummoxed, but I also think being at the top of the ticket might have helped.
Well, he had 9%, and Bill Daley certainly would have loved a couple of those.
Yeah, right.
Two very big disappointments for the night for Mendoza and Chico in terms of what they were expecting. Both of them had reasonable hopes of being in that final two, and both of them just like nothing there,
especially Gary.
Well, then what do we think of the final two candidates? Is this a good, you know, did the system distill two really good choices for Chicago?
It's definitely two paths, right? You've got someone who's part of the machine, and that's going to be a big part of the conversation, and Lori Lightfoot, who everyone seems to think represents progress more than Preckwinkle. I think that they both, you know, are representative of a lot of desires. I heard Lori Lightfoot's conversation this morning, and it sounds like she's cobbling together some of the other messages from the other campaigns, like whatever's left over.
I know that Tony Preckwinkle is the chairwoman of the Democratic Party. I know that. But how, you tell me, Eric and Scott, how machiney is she? Because, I mean, she had always been a social do-gooder, I thought.
It's very interesting to look back at the history because she started the Reform Caucus. She was one of the five people, she'll tell you this many times, that she voted against the parking meter deal. She was not a get-along, go-along part of the machine. And, you know, the machine is held together with chewing gum and rubber bands these days. It's not what it was by any means. The machine, but there is this organization. Go ahead, Peg.
No, I think that the fact that she came in second shows that the machine might have been working pretty well.
I mean, this is if you take a really broad view of like the institutional.
Establishment is a better word.
Establishment is probably better than machine. And you know, she's going to have a lot of public union support. But I don't think Lori Lightfoot is an enemy of the public union. You're going to see like a very bitter campaign fought over very small differences. And it's going to be a lot of who's the insider, who's the outsider, who's the true voice of change, and who's going to just keep things going the way they are. It's not going to be fought on a lot of policy grounds, because I don't think there's a huge difference in the way these two women approach policy.
But to say that Preckwinkle's not part of the machine, part of the establishment, whatever word you want to use, is absurd. I mean, she's a fourth ward hack. She gave the unions everything they wanted and more during negotiations as president of the county commission. You know, the delineation between her and Lightfoot is pretty strong in that regard.
Well, did we miss a chance here? I mean, was there somebody that we thought, oh man, it's too bad?
No.
Because they would have been our savior, right? I mean, I'm still asking you guys, if we distilled two good choices for the people of Chicago, this is a big deal.
I think both women are going to be good mayors. I'd say either one is going to be good
in
mayor.
The context of the city, in city politics, they're two very good candidates.
What do we say about the fact that, what was the final voter turnout? What did it hold at 30%?
34. It was 33, 34. It did not break a record for the lowest turnout.
Come on, guys. Yeah. Well, but does it matter that much? We had this conversation briefly on the radio. I mean, it's sort of like the primaries that people don't get that interested in four-year elections, but then they show up maybe for the general election. The runoff is the one that I suspect will get a higher number, right?
It did last time. When Chuy Garcia and Rahm Emanuel were in the runoff, they got like 42%, I want to say.
Citywide, we ran a thing in the Trib that says that that's absolutely true. There's usually a tick up of 8 to 10%.
I get that. But, I mean, 4 years ago, Rahm Emanuel was running for re-election. There was a question of whether there would be a runoff. He was going to be one of the two. In this one, it seemed to have been wide open. I thought there would be more people wanting to have their say.
I did a column on that for this morning, and it talked about how this, and they noticed this in business as well. So it's called the paralysis of choice, which is you have so many things to choose from that you can't choose, and you just go, I can't choose. It's too much. And they find this in things like, you know, salad dressing or jams at the
jelly.
Store.
I feel like there's too much stuff. That's why I told you that on Tuesday night. That was the conversation we were having, is that given too many choices, people choose nothing.
Malcolm Gladwell wrote about that, right? Where the lady that had the jams in her store, if she only had three, she sold a lot of jelly. People go apple or, you know, cherry or whatever. But then she said, let's put 100 and really expand our revenue base. And then sales went down because people were overwhelmed and they bought nothing. But if you said you want grape, strawberry, or apple, they can pick one of those. 14 different jams, I don't know.
Yeah, so there's some research that says that five is about the overload.
Is that
point.
It?
Yeah,
is
you
it?
Have five choices, and then and after that, people are like, I can't make a
Boy,
choice.
Boy, the National Democrats are screwed.
I talked to people on Tuesday who were headed to the polls and didn't and weren't sure who they were going to vote for.
I stood before that piece of paper and made the decision as I stroked the pen.
And
literally, that was the process.
Really?
I was that
Wow.
The one person we're not talking about who was actually didn't win, but he won. He won the most number of precincts, and that's Willie Wilson. Is he a player in this? I mean, if he comes out and says, I endorse...
You know, I mean, he's basically a Republican, okay? I mean, he said he voted for Trump. He supported Rauner. I mean, he doesn't really admit to it anymore, but he's a Republican. So neither of these two candidates are Republican adjacent.
But they both called him that night, election night, and then
sure.
both said,
so Willie, we always loved you. You were always my second choice.
Is he really a player?
Yeah, that can help. I don't know how much endorsements like that or newspaper endorsements or anything make a difference. But
one last thing about the personal politics here. Does Lori Lightfoot, being a gay, female, African-American, help or hurt or matter at all? Is that kind of a neutral point since her other opponent is also a female and African-American?
I have heard the theory that she's not going to get the black church lady vote on the South Side, and the fact that she didn't do all that well in the black ward suggests that maybe that is a factor. I think it was on Patty's show, though, Hermine was saying that's the old way.
Black churches tend to be, and this is
very
my experience,
conservative.
Very conservative socially, and I think that's going to be a problem. That could be a problem there. I think she's just a really strong candidate.
She's really
smart. Her presence, and you look at these two, and this is ultimately the nut graph. Is ultimately you look at these two, and you can see either of them being mayor of the city.
Absolutely.
And that's where, but then that plays to Lori Lightfoot's advantage because she's not some firebrand.
Think about this. If Lori Lightfoot is elected mayor, we will have a black woman mayor. We'll have a black woman on the head of the county board. We'll have a black woman state's attorney. We'll have a black woman running the Chicago Public Schools.
Lieutenant governor.
The lieutenant governor, the treasurer, the county clerk. I mean, the black women no matter what happens, black women have a lot of power in this area. it's kind of cool.
See?
You think about how the years of white men have had it and we haven't even
Latina's
noticed.
Got a lot
I
of
want
work
to amend what I said
That's
about
true.
Lori Lightfoot's body language, too, and that is
it's not
that
a competition.
She's,
it feels like it.
When Lori comes into the studio, she's just so retiring and she's so petite. When she talks, she's really good. I think she gave me a terrific interview. She did you, too.
Yeah, she's very serious.
But when she walks into a room, she's not a stacker of wheat, this Lori Lightfoot. It'll just be interesting.
It will be the biggest height differential, I think, in any race in the country.
That is not what you would expect a mayor of Chicago to look like.
Scott's going to have a field day, the cartoonist with a tall and the short candidate.
Well, we've had a tiny mayor for pocket-sized mayors now for generations.
The last one who didn't fit in a pocket was Harold Washington, right?
Maybe so. Michael Cohen has testified before the House Oversight Committee. It's been riveting. Has it been productive? I don't know. Republicans get a chance to call him a liar, and Democrats get a chance to ask embarrassing questions that have no answers because we don't know if we can trust him.
I think it's hard to take seriously a guy who's testifying, who's going to jail for lying to Congress as he talks to Congress. But the thing you have to take away from this is the physical evidence he introduced, and those are the checks signed by the president as the president was lying to us. Now, I've been on conservative radio the last couple of days talking about this, saying we should be as furious about that. We right-wingers should be as furious about that as when another president waggled his finger as, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. It's infuriating. It's not against the law, but he lied to us. And why aren't you mad about this?
I know he lied under oath before, but I believe what he's saying. I believe that, I think he's telling the truth because he would, putting himself, he's got 3 years in prison or something like that.
Right.
He's putting himself in jeopardy of more by coming in if he tells more lies.
regardless of how you feel about the president.
And this thing just the other day in North Korea where he stands up for North Korea and saying that he doesn't, was it, what's the kid's name, Warmbier, Otto Warmbier?
Kid.
He's just like, oh, yeah. I asked him about that. He didn't, you know, Kim didn't know about
that.
A lot of people
in North Korea, you know, a lot of people.
Those jails are tough.
I can't believe people are still sticking by him and not selling drugs, but they do.
To his credit, he did leave Vietnam without some sort of
I thought that was a smart play. I also think he was anxious to get back here because all the cameras were over here instead of over there.
What, this guy's a deal maker. He goes over there. Anybody knows the first thing about diplomacy. You don't have these summits without everything being worked out in
advance.
That's
old school. Yeah. I think it was the plan to walk out early. Kim is going to agree to completely denuclearize.
Well, he said he did last time.
And so he goes over there, and if he hits a home run, fine. But I think they had the plane on idle the whole time, just figuring, you know, that's part of his negotiation. You know what else is part of his negotiation? Is the sucking up to Kim, saying, but he's a great guy, and it's offensive to us to hear that. Ultimately, that will play on that little boy in North Korea's mind. I actually think that it operates on such a juvenile level.
Unless he is as ignorant as Trump, he will not fall for that, because he knows the only reason he gets a summit with this little tiny country, right? I mean, North Korea is this poor, tiny little crappy country. And the only reason he gets a summit with the president of the United States is because they've got their nukes. He gives up his nukes, he's going to be pulled out of a rat hole like Saddam. You know, he knows that, or he's going to be killed like Gaddafi. He is not, unless he's really dumb, he's not going to agree to give up his nukes.
I just want to go back though and wrap it up on the Cohen testimony. I talked to Congresswoman Robin Kelly from Chicago a little while ago, and we were talking about the purpose of this Cohen hearing, and I said to her, so what really are you guys doing, right? Because it's like Stormy Daniels, and there was a check, and he lies.
And maybe apartments in Moscow.
Maybe he had a love child, and maybe he hit Melania, but he's got the tape, but he won't release the tape. Does he have a tape of him hitting Melania in an elevator? It was going back and forth like that, and I thought, what is the purpose of these hearings? And she says, well, we're oversight. We just oversee the executive branch, and it's our job to just check on him, see how he's doing.
They're laying a predicate to subpoena his tax records.
Right, that seemed to be pretty good.
And get him on insurance.
Eric Zorn, Patty Vasquez, Steve Bertrand, that's part of the Mincing Rascals podcast crew. We drop a fresh new one for you every Thursday around 5 o'clock. It always has a fun video pre-roll. You'll see the gang engage in hijinks and then go to some highbrow conversation there. Thank you, Eric Zorn from the Tribune, Scott Stannis, our Patty Vasquez and Steve Bertrand True, too. That's the Mincing Rascals. Now, speaking of the weather, sort of, remember now, next week we will be springing forward. We will, Saturday night, 1 week from tonight, go to bed and set our clocks ahead 1 hour. And that means that as nice as it has been getting out of the buildings here, say it's 6 o'clock in the evening and it's still light out, that'll be 7 o'clock in the evening next Sunday morning. Woof, woof, woof. Oh, that's right. Griff, I don't know if that's something that we all want to do, but the gang is taken up to barking like dogs to show affirmation this week. And I'm not sure that that's really a thing that we all need to further, right? Even if you're good at it, like Don Kleppen is.
Bork.
A friend of mine told me, I don't have time for this right now. I'm going to probably pursue this on my show this week, but I don't know if you guys have a quick answer and you can say, hey, dummy, no, you don't need to dwell on this. His credit card information was stolen and somebody was using his credit card. It wasn't him. They didn't physically have the card. They had the number. He thinks he knows where his credit card was compromised, a store he went to, and then shortly thereafter, somebody started making purchases with that same number. Is there a way to find out? He said there ought to be an algorithm or something where they can just go back to the last place. And if that's been a place where frequently people whose credit has been compromised have also shopped, then the cops know to go after somebody there. Because when you think how often you read your credit card to somebody over the phone, or you'll fill out a form with it or do it online, you know, as much as we've encrypted things and tried to protect ourselves, we just give our credit card number away every day. And he's thinking, I think I know where it happened, but I can't prove it. And I thought, yeah, how is it that they don't know? Because you can tell where you use, it's all, there's a digital footprint for everything. Don, do you know if there's a way to know where the last time your credit card was used that it was compromised?
I was just looking online for something like that. I know that for ATM skimmers, for instance, there is sort of a definitive way to determine, obviously, if an ATM has been compromised. I think what you, in this case, there are apps like Crime Spotters or like Reporters and stuff where you can report that you think that this is the place that you've, that your card was compromised, and then hopefully the police would then investigate, and if they found that multiple people were reporting the same thing, then maybe they could figure out that a place was.
Yeah.
But in terms of like a specific algorithm to kind of like punch it in and find out if a place is suspect or whatever, I can't find anything that's
they
like that.
They have that for bed bugs.
True. That's right.
You can dial up bed bugs, and they'll tell you where all of the bed bug bites occur most frequently in hotels in Chicago. And by the way, Chicago hotels and motels, a lot of bed bug stores.
Ooh,
or,
yeah.
Or places.
Oh, yeah.
I know. I'm like, I've seen these and go, oh, no. Oh, no. But why can't they do that with credit cards and then determine where are the places that you're most likely to get your card compromised?
It's great. It would be great, especially now, as you said, when everyone's, you know, we all give our credit cards away.
It's like amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to work on that this week. Says, thank you, Don Kleppen. John Williams here on WGN Radio. Hey, Griff, what was that?
Wow, man.
That was the original score from the motion picture If Beale Street Could Talk. It was one of the nominated scores from almost a week ago at
you
the
would
Oscars.
Do that. You would do that. Do
well, yeah.
That's not a bad thing, Griff. It's
no,
just, it's so you.
Well, sure.
this is our Vibe Score segment. We always talk on Saturdays at this time about a few things in the news that don't really make the news. Sometimes it's music and the arts. Griffin always starts us off with some piece of music that he thinks we might benefit from knowing about. And today it's the theme from If Beale Street Could Talk.
Yeah, that's a track called Agape. And it is one of the main themes from If Beale Street Could Talk. And again, that score was nominated. It's composed by Nicholas Britell.
It was lovely.
Yeah.
It's one of the best pieces of movie music I've heard in a very long time. And I'm just a fan of scores. It was exciting to see it nominated. I was pulling for it on Sunday night. It lost to the score from Black Panther, which was kind of, I didn't really expect it to win, but I was hoping. But I've been listening to this walking around. It's
no kidding.
And the whole, all of the music in that movie, it's worth seeing for the music alone. The movie's also great itself, but I would really send people, because I think it's going a little bit overlooked too. I mean, it was nominated and that was great. But I don't know if people are talking a lot about how incredible that music is.
They're not. If when you're listening to that in your headphones, Griff, and you're walking around, do you find that your feet actually start to go off the ground?
Honestly, like
you start to levitate.
Not a bad question, because
slow down up.
It has that feeling that there's a few main themes in this movie that are equally good too. So it just all throughout. I just wanted to play it.
So people, were you recommending they listen to that song or the whole soundtrack from If Beale Street?
Oh, you could do the whole thing. And a couple songs have a similar melodic progression as that one does. And then there's a couple other themes that run through it, but they kind of return to it.
That one was Agape, you said?
That's called Agape.
Nice.
And there's another one called Eden Harlem that sounds very similar. That's by Nicholas Britell. He did the music for Vice this year also. He did Barry Jenkins' other movie, Moonlight, a couple years ago. So they've worked together a couple times now. He also did the theme song for the show Succession on HBO.
Hmm.
So he's a rising star in film composing, and really exciting. I love most of his music.
Am I remembering correctly, Black Klansman had a fun soundtrack because it was of that era?
That was also nominated, yeah.
Yeah, it was a good one.
The soundtrack was really good, and the score specifically was had a great kind of guitar theme.
And yeah. I'm thinking less about the score as just the soundtrack, because they were just tapping really in a fun way into that whole 70s vibe.
Yeah, when you set a movie in that era, you've got a lot to work with. A lot of people do like to dip into that. Yeah.
So, here we go now. Joe had to step out. He's got to do a game. 1 to 100, that melodic score that Griffin was giving us. Griff, what's your vibe on that?
100.
Into the newsroom. Clep and go.
Yeah, I'm giving that a 99. That ethereal flair right there, man. I'm all about that. That was nice.
If Joe or Harry's probably listening, he goes, well, what would I be doing when I listen to that? Why would I listen to that? For what purpose?
I think you gave him the best answer. You're walking around, you feel like you're floating.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's right.
I liked it. I don't believe in hundreds, though, or 99s for that matter, so... I'm giving it a 92, some of my highest scores there, Griff. Well done.
Don, did you watch the Oscars? I know we're almost a week away, but we haven't talked since then.
Right, yeah, that's true. I caught it muted, you know, like on a bar TV screen. So I
the best way to do it, honestly.
that's usually the way that I end up consuming the Oscars, yeah.
I thought it was a great show, guys. I thought it was a great show.
It was, and there was so much projection that it was going to be terrible because... they announced so many things and then took them back, and it was just a nightmare run-up to the Oscars. And then the show was really good.
I think the Oscars should get an Emmy this year. And when I was watching it, 10 minutes in, I thought, why did they ever have a host?
Yep.
Right.
This is moving along just swell.
Yep.
Just swell.
That was one thing I felt, is that like it was moving, the segments and the awards were moving very well comparatively when there's like bits and stuff scheduled in between.
And made you look back on some of the things they did that used to eat up time, like delivering food to everybody in the crowd because they felt like they just had to entertain us so much. And I'm like, no, just get those beautiful people up, show clips of the movies, and let them talk a little bit.
Yeah, the Academy's under like a real crisis of confidence. Like, what should this show actually be?
Yeah.
Because people don't want us to watch just handout awards. That's, the regular person is bored by that. But I just don't think that's true. Like, you're the Oscars, be the Oscars.
Yeah, exactly.
The viewership will go down because it's going down across the board for every... television program there is.
Yeah. Right.
You can't worry about that anymore. It just has to be the show, and like people will like it. And there was actually a small rise in viewership over last year, although it's a downward trend.
Yeah, no kidding. Interesting to know. Here's my thing for you guys to score 1 to 100. I had some gadgets delivered to me this week, unsolicited, by a company that wants to get some publicity. One was a gadget you can stick on your airplane window. Think about that. You've got the window seat in an airplane, and you stick this thing on there, and it's a tray for your cups and your Kleenex and your candy and stuff. So it's a little gadget you bring onto the plane, and then you can have a little extra workspace there by sticking it into the airplane window. I don't want people messing with the infrastructure of my airplanes, number one. But number two, they've also got a gadget where you can keep the person in front of you from being able to put their seat back.
Nice.
Okay. What do we think of the gadget that prevents the person in front of you from putting their seat back? Don Klep and go.
I'll give that also a 99, because that is like, that's great. I know that they always make a big deal like, oh, you still got plenty of leg room, and they only come back like 2 or 3 inches. But man, when everybody's on that airplane, those 2 or 3 inches are crucial.
Don gives it a 99. Griffin.
I fear conflict. If the person in front of you is like trying to put their seat back and they notice they can't, and then they notice you have some scaffolding put up behind them or whatever
it is. It is a little thing.
But they probably wouldn't notice that yet because this thing is new. They're not going to expect that.
Yeah, but now
it's
they're jamming. I can just see this guy rocking it back on, what the hell? Hey, a stewardess, sir. And by the way, he's already in trouble because he just called her stewardess.
Right.
But
right.
He gets the flight attendant to come over, and what's the deal? And now we're at 30,000 feet and there's a fussy people. I don't want that either, Greg.
That's true.
Yeah. No, I don't fly enough to really have a take on this, but I would not use it myself. I know that. I had actually, on a podcast that I listened to, a host brought up another like contentious point in air travel. Tell me what you think.
Go ahead. You going to help me a little bit?
Yes, I'm going to explain it. What do you think of air travel? Let's get into it. No.
What's the deal?
Well, that's going to give you a clue as to what this area of contention is.
I was attempting to, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay,
why don't we do it?
It's people putting the bag overhead, and it's too big and it doesn't fit in.
Oh, I see. No, that's not it. But that, yeah, sure. I mean, there's a million, but here's one. When people put their windows, when they close the window.
Yeah.
So you can't look out.
Mm-hmm.
And that, her point was that that seems to be a pretty default thing. Like, everyone does that when they get on the plane now. And she doesn't like that.
I don't either. And she's right.
And she opens her window, and she'd been asked occasionally to even close her window, and she causes a big fuss when that happens. She says no.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. If I got the window seat, it's my prerogative, man.
And look, I got to sit over here in the window seat, so I'm going to look out the window, Jack.
You know, lucky you.
If you're on the aisle, I'll trade you. But I'm sorry, I think that's the right of the window person.
I guess just general like lack of being impressed by the miracle of flight.
Boring out there. Just close the window.
I don't fly enough to really have opinions again. But like. Yeah, that does seem sad.
No, I think, I think that's so well put, Griff. Not sufficiently impressed with the miracle of flight. I was flying through the Rocky Mountains to Denver not that long ago, or, you know, I was going over mountains, and I just thought, what a miracle this is. I'm having a beer, 30,000 feet in the air, reading a magazine, flying over the flipping Rocky Mountains, and complaining about turbulence, you know? I mean,
and watching a movie otherwise.
I know. And we were so, you know, unimpressed with that anymore. We need to step back and go, you know, they used to, like, spend 6 months in wagons walking this thing, right? So this is pretty cool. Pretty cool. Don, you got something for us real quick?
Yeah, real quick. I've been doing a story today about how scientists discovered a huge underground water system on Mars, which is supposedly, you know, they said it was there was always water there, but now they think it exists currently underground and it stretches across the entire planet.
Wow.
Which increases the likelihood that they're, you know, they'll find evidence of life having been there and the possibility that it might still be there. And so now I'm imagining this gigantic underground planet-sized lake in, you know, under the surface of Mars, and this giant, you know, Martian dragon swimming around in that in that thing.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, what's your vibe on the giant potential Martian dragon that we're going to discover when we get out there? 1 to 100.
Let's be very clear. This is not the news.
No, the news is just the water.
You hear Don's voice right now, but he's not doing the news at the moment. This is wild conjecture.
Big service there, Griff. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. Yeah, this is the total speculation on my part. But yeah, I'm vibing with.
I'm 92 again on this, Donnie boy. You know, that's my wheelhouse. I love that kind of stuff, and I'm rooting for the Martian life. Go, man, go.
It's very exciting. Yeah, no, I love that story, and I think today is kind of a big day for SpaceX.
Yeah.
It is, yeah.
They, I don't know what happened there.
They launched a I was doing that story too. I'm going to try and find it. I can't see the details, but it's up in the sky right now.
Right now, yeah.
And it's got a dummy robot there before, I think humans will be on the next one if this one goes well.
Now, that's not going to Mars. That's just for kind of commercial.
It's going to the International Space Station. That's right.
Because you know, every time we send somebody to the International Space Station, we write a check $8 million per guy to Russia. Russia's our taxi. We are Ubering to the space station via Russia.
Ugh.
And it's like $8 million a guy a trip.
And you know they're bumping like trans music the whole shuttle ride up there too.
But if you just wait 15 minutes, maybe it's $7
million. Surge pricing.
That's right. If you want to go with some Japanese, you can actually get a rate. It's 11:51. That's our Vibe Score segment. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Griff. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Producer Griffin, today. Joe Brand did sports for us, and Don Kleppen in the newsroom. You know, I still won't have time. This is the bane of a two-hour show to talk as much about Cliff Sims' book as I was going to. But I mentioned it earlier, and I'll just finish this segment with one just quick note about the book that I just finished and enjoyed more than I thought I would, called Team of Vipers. Team of Vipers is written by the former special assistant to the president. He had 500, he says, extraordinary days in the Trump White House. He was the guy that sometimes tweeted for the president. He did the president's videos, and he became an ear to the president and a helper to him. Sometimes he carried his hair product. He really was just outside the Oval Office. And it was inside the Oval Office for some extraordinary moments. Team of Vipers, when it first came out, was pitched to all of us as a sort of disgruntled former Trump guy. And now he's, you know, telling you what a terrible person Donald Trump was, and that's a misrepresentation of the book. When the book first came out, everybody grabs it, and then they say, okay, quick, give me a really good anecdote. And they all went to the one where the president is trying to get rid of Obamacare and put in his Republican health care plan. So Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, he's the wonk. He comes in with Mike Pence to tell Donald Trump how it's going to happen. And as Ryan is talking about it in detail, Trump doesn't have an attention span for it, and he's not interested in the details. And so he famously now just sort of stands up as Ryan is talking. And you know how in a conversation you might stretch your legs and walk around the room thoughtfully, but no, Trump actually stands up and walks out of the room. And he's in the adjacent room now, and next thing they know, they hear the TV go on, and he's watching TV. And Pence looks at Ryan, and he goes, all right, I'll fix this. So now Pence goes in there and says, Mr. President, you really do got to listen to this. And then Donald Trump sort of reluctantly comes back in, and Ryan had stopped talking by now, but when Trump walked out, he was still talking to an empty chair, because at least Pence was there, and he didn't know what the hell was going on. Okay, there's stories like that. And this is the guy who, when Sean Spicer went out to say that that was the largest inaugural crowd ever, this is the guy who said, who wrote the words that Spicer read. And he regrets it to this day. I'll skip the clip, Griff, but he regrets it to this day because he said, the stuff that we told Spicer to say was not true. We were trying our best. We were under the gun. The president wanted us to fix this thing. And so we were just throwing stuff against the wall. Spicer said it, and it wasn't true. And that ushered in the Trump era. But he says that Trump is an extraordinarily talented and stunningly, how did he put it? He said he is extraordinarily talented, but a man with stunning shortcomings. So he gives you sort of that view. He's on Team Trump. He said, I was proud to serve the presidency and this president per se. But he also gives you a lot of the warts in the administration. Kellyanne Conway does not come out well in the reading of Team of Vipers. It's 11:57. Okay, the stories that matter from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom come your way in just a minute. Amy Guth just strolled into the studio. I got to play one more quick commercial, Amy, then we'll come to you. That's Nick.
Hello. How's it going?
Good. So what are some of the highlights coming up this afternoon?
Well, some highlights include we're going to be talking about how Illinois is preparing to legalize sports betting and what that will look like should that come to pass. All signs point to that being a good possibility. And then we're also going to talk about kind of the boom of apartments in downtown Chicago and about demand and kind of what that looks like. Just to take a look at the rental market.
What's higher, demand or supply?
Well, it's kind of interesting, and we're going to be talking about that with a reporter from Crain's Chicago Business, because it's a little bit surprising. Like, suddenly there's all these apartments, and it seemed like it was just not going to go well, and there would be some kind of bust, but it seems like demand is keeping up with
no
it pretty
kidding.
Well. So,
yeah. Have a really good show, Amy Guth, and thanks again, Griffin and Joe and Don. I'll talk to you Monday at 1.